From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
I'm from San Jose.
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Metate in San Francisco.
Coming up, a giant goes down for using performance-enhancing drugs. We'll forecast what's next for athletes looking for a boost. Then we go to a local salon and talk Olympians, vanity, and hair.
And that's what pretty is, straight hair. That's what we're taught. Not saying that that's right, but that's what we're taught.
And we'll embark on a search for the perfect falafel in a Bay Area falafel shop hop.
I make it all yummy. I like it. And then I make it again and again.
That and more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The next chapter in the story of athletes and performance-enhancing drugs has been written, and it takes place in San Francisco. Yesterday, Giants left fielder Melky Cabrera was suspended for the rest of the year without pay by Major League Baseball for failing a drug test. He had high levels of testosterone. KALW's Ben Trefney reports.
Shortly after his suspension, Cabrera released a statement through the Players Union. He said, "My positive test was the result of my use of a substance I should not have used." The rare admission is a major blow to the Giants' playoff hopes. Cabrera emerged as a superstar this year, leading the National League in hits and runs. He was also named Most Valuable Player of the All-Star Game. The revelation can also be seen as a setback, or maybe a success, for pro sports. Drug testing evidently worked this time, but top athletes are clearly still doping. At the Olympic Games, the winner in the women's shot put had her gold medal revoked when a drug test came back positive. But another event that took place in London may say more about the future of performance enhancements.
And there's the start in a land-breaking moment for the Olympic Games.
Oscar Pistorius from South Africa advanced to the semifinals in the men's 400-meter race, as heard here on NBC. Unremarkable, except he was running on two prosthetic legs. He's known as the Blade Runner. His is the heroic story of a man overcoming seemingly impossible odds, as well as a court battle with officials who wanted to keep him from competing. But it also ignited controversy regarding what could enhance an athlete's performance, as reported here by Mark Phillips of CBS News.
Not just the blades are an issue. Some say he's also lighter without lower limbs, and so potentially faster.
And Pistorius finishing in second place with Quao in third.
Performance-enhancing drugs, such as steroids or human growth hormone, are currently illegal. The potential for prosthetics, at least in the Olympics, has only recently been allowed. But as athletes continue to compete for glory or for multi-million dollar contracts, the limits of human performance will continue to be pushed, even beyond what seems possible. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.
We want to hear your thoughts about this. Which enhancements do you think should be allowed, if any? Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and leave us a message. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hinat Baba. That's the sound of Gabrielle Douglas winning gold in a gymnastics individual all-around competition a couple of weeks ago. She's one of the many apparently clean Olympians coming home to great fanfare this week. While the world will remember Gabby's phenomenal skill and poise, a few people decided to focus on something that had nothing to do with her competition, her hair.
First of all, the girl is 16 years old. How many of y'all had it all together at 16? Black women were making a big deal about this little girl's hair, about how it looks a mess. Hold up, y'all. First off, she's a gymnast.
Her hair? It's too gelled. Too many pins. Why is she wearing a ponytail? Why doesn't someone do a makeover? F*** you.
A handful of negative tweets about the Olympian's hairdo initiated a heated debate online about vanity, ethnicity, and hair texture that carried over to mainstream media. That got KALW's Leela Day thinking about cultural identity and how hair plays into that in the African American community. So she visited the one place where this discussion happens every day, her hair salon. Hot combs sit in metal cases. Flat irons are steaming with red lights announcing they're ready to press out some curls. The slight smell of burn from ironed hair and citrus from deep conditioners fill the air. Ladies in business suits sit cross-legged in leather chairs, their hair in various stages of getting done. I'm at the hair salon again. I come once a month to get my hair in a double-strand twist, a style that lasts a couple of weeks. You see, my hair is in transition. It's been pressed, weaved, braided, dreaded, and straightened over the years. Right now, it's naturally curly at the roots and chemically straight on the ends. It kind of reminds me of Olympian Gabby Douglas's hair. That's why, when everyone started talking about her hair being a mess, it definitely got my attention.
We're just hard on each other, especially when it comes to the hair. That's the crown. It starts from there, and that, like, that's kind of symbolizes when your hair is done and when it's not. You know, are you taking care of yourself? And it's always about the hair.
That's Fritz Clay. He's the owner of Hair Play, a salon in San Francisco that specializes in multi-ethnic hair care. He describes it as a place where hair and culture come together. Women come here to get every kind of hairstyle, from twists, weaves, natural afro styles with tight curls, to straight, relaxed hair that's chemically processed.
I had an afro wig in the 70s, you know, with belt buckles.
Marguerite Brown comes in once a week for a wash and deep condition.
I actually had a boyfriend once pour water on my head, and he said, "Now leave it like that." He liked it better natural, and after I sort of looked at it and got used to it, I realized that he was right.
The natural versus processed hair question is a big one. There's even an entire documentary about black hair produced by comedian Chris Rock, where he talks about the psychology behind what it means to have, quote, good hair.
Just yesterday, my daughter came into the house and said, "Daddy, how come I don't have good hair? I wonder how she came up with that idea."
For some women, getting a relaxer helps transform what they consider bad hair to good by straightening out the natural texture. It's a chemical process that, if done well, can last around 60 days. But when it doesn't go well, it can leave open wounds on the scalp. It sometimes includes chemicals like lye, lithium, or potassium hydroxide. Unfortunately, the pressure to get your hair relaxed can start early, sometimes as young as 6 years old, says stylist April Clay.
We're taught that our hair is nappy, it's kinky, it doesn't look good, it's not pretty unless it's straight. And we've been like that ever since we've been born. Like, you know, growing up, grandma in the kitchen, pressing your hair, going to Sunday school, getting your hair pressed out, old enough to get a relaxer, you get a relaxer, get it straight. And that's what pretty is, straight hair. That's what we're taught. Not saying that that's right, but that's what we're taught.
The hair talk fills the salon, and other women start chiming in. It doesn't take long for Gabby Douglas and her hair to come up.
I heard that people were on Facebook making comments saying, like, how come her mother didn't do her hair, or how come her hair wasn't done?
And I think that it had something to do with that she represents us.
And when I heard it, it made me upset for people to sit up and criticize her for her hair not being done, but at the same time, she was a gymnast.
I will tell you that when I was watching her perform as a Virgo, I did say, okay, but I never would have said anything about it.
It was nappy. No, but really, I didn't care, to be honest. I really didn't care. I feel like she's an athlete. She works hard. That's one of the least things that she has to worry about right now.
I don't know why we have to be so crazy about our hair.
Why are we so crazy about our hair?
Because we want to look like white people, I guess. I don't know.
I didn't think her hair looked unkept. It didn't look any different than the other gymnasts. It was pulled back.
Keitha Pansy is getting her hair washed and styled. She's been coming twice a month for 11 years now. She's a runner and has chemically relaxed hair. She knows all about trying to find a hairdo that works with an active lifestyle.
I only wear my hair down 2 days after Denise does it, and then the rest of the time it is pulled back in a bun.
Why is that?
Because I exercise every day, and I mean, we have black hair. I can't wash it every day. I don't have time to blow it out. You know, I work out for like
Pansy sacrificing her hair for her workout is actually a real issue for many black women. Earlier this month, the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Regina M. Benjamin, judged a competition at an international hair show in Atlanta. Stylists competed to showcase looks that could withstand a workout. It was meant to encourage women of color to refrain from using their hair as an excuse not to exercise.
My name is Chinwe Onyegoro. I am just doing a wash and a set, so just a wash and a style.
As Onyegoro waits for her hair to be pressed, she says the chatter around Gabby's hair really stems from a lack of self-esteem.
I think there's a certain level of envy that manifests itself in really negative and debasing comments instead of, you know, congratulating and praising and really showing a sense of pride as to, you know, what Gabby brought to our community. What people do is their fear is that any spotlight on Gabby takes away from them and their own personal sense of self-esteem. If Gabby can do this and rise to the Olympics, why can't they do more in their own lives?
She's going to do bigger things. And you know what? Sometimes
she already has.
Yes, but she's going
to
do.
Next to the shampoo bowls, the talk about Gabby Douglas gets personal.
To make you continue to fight. So she can stand there with her head held high and walk fly. If she don't want to comb her hair, she don't have to. You know what I mean? Because that's, she's my sister.
That seems to be how many people see Gabby Douglas. Perhaps their little sister, their best friend at school, their daughter, or themselves. People feel like they have something in common with her, so they either criticize her or defend her passionately. Today I asked Victor, my hairstylist, to shape my hair into double strand twists, as usual. A style that will only endure a week or so of exercise and humid San Francisco fog. I must admit it, I have used hair as an excuse not to exercise. Come on, I spend $85 every time I go to the salon. It's a lifestyle choice. How hard do you want to push yourself this week? Is it worth sweating out your hair? Well, for Gabby Douglas it was. It got her an Olympic gold. In San Francisco, I'm Leela Day for Cross Currents.
We want to hear what issues you deal with on a personal level, and maybe we'll feature it on the show. Leave us a message on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I looked in the mirror for the first time and saw that, hey, I am not my hair. I am not this skin. I am not your expectations. No, no. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. While hair was a side issue at the Olympics, another cultural issue had to do with athletes coming from Muslim countries. This year, the Olympics coincided with the Islamic month of Ramadan, when Muslims around the world fast from dawn to dusk from food and drink. And many Muslim Olympians this year had a hard time keeping the fast while competing in their sports. Well, the Olympics are over, and Ramadan is almost over as well. We're in the final days. And for Middle Eastern Muslims, one of the lunch foods soon to be found on many tables is falafel. To many Americans, falafel is a fried ball of mashed up garbanzo beans that you could put in a sandwich. But to me, falafel reminds me of where I'm from, Sudan. Until recently, I thought there was really only one way to make it. But turns out there are many ways to fry a falafel, depending on where you come from. And of course, everyone thinks theirs is the best. So I headed out on a falafel shop hop to see if there really is a falafel top chef in the Bay Area. I decided to start in the East Bay in Fremont.
My name is Ramzi Totri. Originally, I was born in Nazareth, Israel. And my dad had a falafel shop in Nazareth.
Totri is owner of Falafel Etc. in Fremont. He went to college in this country, worked in the high-tech industry for many years, but he returned to his roots with falafel.
The falafel is part of the tradition. in every one of the Middle Eastern countries. Every street corner has a falafel stand on it. They don't have hamburger stands, they have falafel stands.
Totri is an Israeli-Palestinian, and where he comes from, Jews and Palestinians alike make falafel with garbanzo beans, like what I'm used to in Sudan. We're looking at a batch ready for frying.
The yellow color is the garbanzo beans, which is 95% of the mix. We add onions, garlic, parsley, cilantro, cumin.
But just before frying, Chef Ramzi adds a bit of baking soda to fluff up the falafel, he says, to make it lighter. And as my mother always told me, the oil must be hot, just like Chef Ramzi's. So the falafel balls dive like swimmers to the bottom and rise back up again.
If you cook it just right, as soon as you put it in the oil, the outside shell seals, and so it doesn't allow oil to get into it.
He's right. Crunchy on the outside, not oily on the inside. And even though he makes it every day, Chef Ramzi never tires of falafel.
Our order is 6 pieces of falafel. I'll make 7. The 7th one is the taxes, you know. Uncle Ramzi has to have his taxes, so I get a falafel and I just eat it by itself. I love eating it by itself.
Despite being proud of his Palestinian-style falafel, Ramzi Totri admits that falafel didn't originate in Palestine or Israel. Experts say it came from Egypt. So I headed over to an Egyptian sandwich shop in San Francisco. The back kitchen of Pharaoh's Mediterranean sandwich shop is stocked with dozens of spices, vegetables, and the smell of cilantro fills the space. Yasmin El Morsi is preparing a fresh batch of falafel mix.
This is the fava beans that was soaked yesterday.
That's right, fava beans, not garbanzo. This is the Egyptian way, and most don't call it falafel. They call it
tameya. Falafel is like an Arab, Syrian, Palestinian word. It's not pure Egyptian word. It's called tameya.
Fava beans are a staple food in Egypt that go as far back as the pharaohs. And paintings inside their tombs, some believe, depict the act of frying falafel. Another theory is that the dish originated with Egypt's Coptic Christians as a substitute for meat during Lent. And now, thousands of years later and thousands of miles later in San Francisco, Yasmin, her father, and 4 brothers are running a restaurant that offers falafel prepared the same way.
It's a family restaurant and with family recipes. My mother's recipe, she passed away, so she teach me and I taught my father and my brothers how to do the recipes.
Yasmin's mother prepared falafel with some of the same ingredients as Chef Ramzi uses in his Palestinian recipe. Parsley, cilantro, onion, all blended together in the food processor. And after she makes it as smooth as possible, the spices are hand-mixed in. Black pepper, sesame, some salt, and the key ingredient, freshly ground coriander.
It makes the taste of the falafel. So be generous with the coriander.
After frying, the falafel rest, draining their oil. And they seem to call out to me to try my first fava bean falafel.
Here we go. Mmm, coriander.
Yeah.
It's very flavorful, and the salt is just right. Mm. And it's like crispy on the outside, but moist on the inside. Not raw,
but
moist.
Yeah. Yasmin says she gets lots of Middle Eastern people coming in, but her Egyptian customers want to make sure they're getting it their way. There's a pride in knowing it's an Egyptian tamiya.
They are asking us, is it pure Egyptian? Do you do it with fava beans or garbanzo beans? No, it's made of fava beans. It's pure fava beans, don't worry.
So that gets me thinking. If falafel originated in Egypt with fava beans, why are many made with garbanzo, including ours in Sudan, which is actually geographically the closest to Egypt? I needed some answers, so I called up renowned cookbook author and food historian Claudia Roden at the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery in England.
Because they use what they grow, and because they grow chickpeas in Israel and Palestine, so it is the one that they would use. You use what is most available.
Ah, so people made it with whatever bean was most plentiful locally. That makes sense. But then there's another way falafel is made. If you're, say, from Lebanon, you combine the two beans. You go half and half.
Garbanzo beans and faba beans. That's my Lebanese way.
Madame Leila Sfer moved here from Lebanon with her husband and children over 30 years ago. She runs this small catering business in Fremont. No surprise, falafel is her most popular dish.
Who makes the best falafel?
Me.
Madame Leila is 72 with the energy of a 30-year-old. She uses a large commercial grinder to mix her ingredients together. She stands on a crate because she's not tall enough to put her half and half mixture in. And when it's done, it looks almost more vegetable-y than beany.
Yours is very green.
And tasty. I put a lot of green. I put the parsley, cilantro. I like it green.
Madame Leila fries her falafel until, she says, they're a magic golden color. And then she grabs a large paper-thin pita bread wrap, puts three falafels on it.
Some tomatoes, tahini sauce, soak it good, some lettuce.
And the falafel sandwich is complete. And it's not just for her customers. Leila Sfer also enjoys making it for her family and neighbors.
I make it all. Yummy! I like it. And then I make it again and again.
As I taste all the styles of falafel, each tasty in its own way, each flavorful, unique, and worthy of its people's unwavering pride, I realize that maybe it's not who makes the best falafel. As food historian Claudia Roden told me, it's the way you were brought up eating it. That means everything to you. We have the recipes from each of the three falafel chefs you heard from, including my mother's recipe, online at kalw.org. That's also where you can see pictures of the falafels and the chefs. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If falafel isn't your thing, maybe a good grilled cheese sandwich is more to your liking. That's what we were banking on last Friday when we invited you out to our first ever Hear Hear Story Slamwich. That's right, a grilled cheese cook-off and storytelling competition. All part of our new initiative Hear Hear, a pop-up radio project. Our chefs ranged from the formidable...
Because I've been in the National Grilled Cheese Competition the past 4 years, and I have 7 trophies now.
To the, well, inventive.
My great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother invented the grilled cheese sandwich, actually.
To the colorful.
Well, Dr. Rainbow is the name I acquired at Burning Man, so I'm bringing the survivor-esque skill set that, you know, I can make a grilled cheese anywhere out of anything, you know, with dust storms in my faces and... You know, really hungover.
Those were the voices of Charles Hodgkins, Michael Davidson, and Dylan Bartley, otherwise known as the Burrito Eater, the Grilled Cheese Guy, and Dr. Rainbow. So who won the grilled cheese cook-off? Well, he said he could make a grilled cheese anywhere.
I'm overwhelmed. I'm verklempt. I was the underdog. Everybody loves an underdog, especially the underdog who wins.
Congratulations to Dr. Rainbow, a.k.a. Dylan Bartley, for his grilled cheese victory. We also invited local storytellers to take a stab at our theme of the evening, food. We heard tales ranging from Jewish deli cravings to vegetarian-turned-meat eaters to family transformations at the dinner table. But in the end...
I would like to proclaim tonight's story slamwich champion, Max McClure.
Our winning story was from a science writer sharing his thoughts on an old enemy, the squid. And here's our story slam champion himself, Stanford University science writer Max McClure.
In 2009, reports started coming in from San Diego to the effect that squid were, quote-unquote, attacking divers. These were Humboldt or jumbo squid, Desiticus gigas, man-sized, 100-pound six-footers, thousands of them, and they had barbed, tooth-like projections ringing every sucker and an apparent grabby interest in the gleaming lights and computers and so on that divers like to tote around. It behooves me to point out that there are no recorded deaths due to Humboldt squid attacks, and the only injuries I've heard of have been to fishermen and meddling biologists. Still, there is something disconcerting about their arrival. The squid are native to the Chilean and Peruvian coast, but they've been moving north for decades. They became California regulars in the 90s, and they've recently been spotted as far north as Alaska. We don't know why. It could be seawater oxygen levels, it could be temperature or overfishing of other species. We do know, however, that they're learning to eat new things. Farther south, Desiticus sticks mainly to minuscule lanternfish, while the ones that spend their time up here have developed a taste for bigger game, salmon, Pacific hake. This is a terrible miscalculation. Those are our fish. In fact, they make up some of the West Coast's largest fisheries. The squid, in essence, have attacked our women and eaten our bread. So what's to be done? According to Chris Cosentino, head chef of San Francisco's Encanto, we eat them. This is courtesy of a Men's Journal article titled Save the Ocean, Eat a Squid, which approximates a lot of the rhetoric surrounding the issue. Eating to defend the homeland. There's nothing wrong with eating squid, but as a military strategy, the idea doesn't make much sense. New invertebrate dishes aren't in the American dietary playbook, especially when the squid flesh in question is most often described as vulcanized. When it comes to changing palates, it seems likely that the squid will outpace us. And it's doubtful that there's an ecological need for a domestic Desiticus market in the first place. But these caveats don't matter. The push for Americans to consume the invading force remains because there is a long human history of wanting to personally eat the things that threaten us. What better way to reassert our apex role than by mystically devouring the pretenders? That's why we have rattlesnake roundups and feral pig hunts. The Maori of New Zealand had a whole genre of songs that expressed the desire to eat one's rival. The people of Tenochtitlan would stand atop their pyramids and rip out the still beating hearts of fallen enemy soldiers, saving the victims' limbs for stewing later. For my money, these are effective displays of dominance. It's worth pointing out here, as an aside, that I know much of what I know about squid because I used to work in the lab of William Gilley, who studies Desiticus and has his own recipes. But I spent my time measuring the electrical impulses of squid neurons. According to tradition, this meant taking the neurons out of their heads first, which you do by decapitating the animal, cutting a slit up the mantle, stripping away a host of paraphernalia, and lifting the relevant pre-nerves to cut the stellate ganglion free of the muscle. If you try a similar procedure in a mouse, and I have, in sort of a general brain removal way, you'll need your protocol approved by a review board. Not so with the squid. Never mind that octopuses modify their environments in a way that looks a lot like tool use, or that cuttlefish communicate with such a complex set of skin patterns that it's been described as a kind of language. While there are laboratory regulations in place for the lowest of vertebrates, there are no federal guidelines for the treatment of cephalopods. There's nothing stopping me from slapping the stuffing out of an octopus, even as it attempts to construct, say, a rudimentary plow. This is just to say that the Humboldt squid is a member of the other, beyond the reach of conventional morality, and that this invites our feelings of aggression. They represent the intellectual acme of an alternate evolutionary strategy. They are bizarro primates. At nearly every single adaptive decision point, they came up with a different solution than we did. They have no backbones. Their eyes are structurally the opposite of ours. They have blue, copper-containing blood. Their worldview doesn't even derive from the same neurobiological hardware we use. Their nerves look different, larger, because cephalopods never developed myelin, which makes our nerves so conductive. Their nervous systems are highly decentralized. I've seen buckets full of ostensibly de-brained octopus, heads floppy and hollow, still capable of grabbing onto your hand and pulling. The cephalopod represents the most profoundly alien intelligence that any of us are likely to encounter. Best to fry them all before they figure out the myelin thing. I bought my own personal Desiticus totem at Manila Oriental Market in the Excelsior. It was off-season and the animal was very small, a mantle length of about a foot. It was markedly non-threatening, curled like offal on a bed of ice. Few animals lose so much in death. There's little in common between the live squid I've seen in videos darting through the mid-ocean with dire, balletic precision, and the late cephalopod, bereft of its seawater support, phlebile splayed out for dissection. And the incantation is like dissection. It starts with you chopping off the ring of arms and tentacles just below the head. Push on the ring's center, and you'll pop the beak right out of the flesh. Drag a knife across the tentacles, and you'll dislodge the hooks. Pull on the head, and it too will readily slide from within the squid mantle, taking the organs with it. It's a convenient packaging job, a simple sleeve of muscle with quick-release innards, an organism designed by Swedes. Peeling away Desiticus's skin with a table knife will be the most time-consuming step by far. Like the cuttlefish, this animal communicates through color changes. You are thus detonguing it, leaving only the silent white latex of victory. Chop into hoops and individual tentacles and fry with breadcrumbs, cumin, red pepper, salt, whatever you have lying around. Serve with pasta and fresh tomatoes. It should taste fine, even without tenderizing. Throw its diminished body down the steps of your pyramid.
That was Stanford University science writer and our Story Slam champion, Max McClure. To hear the full version of this story, visit our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can find out about our community storytelling initiative, Hear Hear, a pop-up radio project. Now, Slam Witch might sound like a peculiar name for a food event, but here in San Francisco, weird names are pretty common. Just ask the Huffington Post, who came up with a list of San Francisco's funniest restaurant names. We polled our newsroom to see which local eateries they would nominate.
A restaurant which has the name that's spelled C-O-I, but is pronounced Qua.
Well, one of my favorite restaurants in the Bay Area is Burma Superstar, which I feel like could only be the name of a restaurant here.
In no language is that pronounced Qua that I'm aware of.
And I also love every time I walk by Turtle Tower in the Tenderloin, I say it Turtle Tower, like I'm from Boston.
Coy. The name of a restaurant that I have the most fun saying is Soup and Kucha.
I'm just going to call it Wow. No, I think, see what they do about that.
You pronounce it Zuppenküche.
Fly Bar, which I think is just the worst name for a restaurant.
Zuppenküche.
I mean, in French, quoi is Q-U-O-I, but not C-O-I.
I just don't know why you would want to associate your name with flies. It's gross.
The Squat and Gobble.
Why would you name a restaurant something that's difficult?
The Sausage Factory.
My favorite restaurant name is Judalicious.
My favorite restaurant name in San Francisco is California.
Send us your favorite funny restaurant names from around the Bay on Facebook. We're at KALW News. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Erica Moo, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Mariel Wallof. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff.
Zuppenküche.
Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener supported radio.
Zuppenküche. I said the world is upside down.
You're hearing the voice and guitar of Robin Galante. The musician, who's also a teacher and writer, is giving a late morning performance at the Creativity Explored Art Space in San Francisco next Tuesday. It's sponsored by Bread and Roses and starts at about 11 a.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Sunshine.